This is John Sayles, and I do a lot of things in the film world, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Hey everybody, this is Adam Chartoff, your host of FilmWax Radio. This is episode number 302. If you hear lots of background noises, it's particularly bad because I am in an open plaza here in the Meatpacking District on a beautiful summer evening in Manhattan. Couldn't be more beautiful out, but I have to record these intros because I'm running late with the show already. And I figure, well, what the fuck? Well, let's do it outside. Who cares? People are staring at me thinking I'm nuts doing this outside in public, but so far nobody's approached me. This is episode number 302. It's a lovely episode. Those opening strains of music you heard, of course, were from the band Guster. The lead guitarist and frontman of that band, Ryan Miller, is on the show today. He'll be coming up in just a little bit. I think I've mentioned for a while now that I'll be bringing on the occasional musician and musical artist, and so here's this is my second show doing that, and so Ryan will be on this episode. And also coming up on this episode in just a few moments is indie film producer Mike Ryan. Regular listeners of this podcast know that last summer I was podcasting from the set of an independent film in New London, Connecticut, called The Missing Girl. I interviewed a bunch of people. I played all of those segments except for this one. This was, again, recorded amidst all those other segments last summer. And I've never played this one. Again, it's producer Mike Ryan. He's big-time producer. I held on to this, though, because I have not had an opportunity to this point. They did not know where the film was going to premiere, and now they know. I can't tell you where. All I can tell you is it's a major international film festival. It's an enormous break for this film. Poor A.D. Calvo, the director, was contacting me all the time and saying to me, you know, what are we going to do? And I'm like, don't worry about it. It's going to work out exactly the way it's supposed to work out. And sure enough, it did. And so we'll make an announcement in a couple of weeks. But why not play this conversation with Mike Ryan, who I really have a lot of respect for. He's doing a lot of great work, and I love just talking to him and hearing about his philosophy of art making, of filmmaking. I think he's dead on, and very few people have the balls to talk about a film the way that Mike Ryan talks about it, in a very, very purist fashion. And so I really admire him, and I'm so excited that he's on the show. And what we're going to do is in about a month or two is we're going to come back and we're going to check in once the announcements have come out. We'll check back in with these guys and start talking about their world premiere of the film The Missing Girl. So coming up first, Mike Ryan. Then we're going to have on Ryan Miller of Guster, a great indie band, which if you don't know them already, they have a new album. It's called Evermotion. It's just coming out, and they're touring, and they're going to be at Summer Stage here in New York City. I'll be there on Monday, July the 20th. I'll be there. And they go to their website just to get all of the details. Go to Guster.com, get all the details. There'll be a Bonnaroo. They're all over the place. They're such a fantastic band. So I thank Ryan for coming on the podcast. Unfortunately, he was in Vermont. I was in New York. We did this over Skype. So there's no live song. Hopefully, one day, Ryan will come back on, and he will play for us live. But in the meantime, I'll just play some of the music of Guster throughout the show. And then last up, there's a new documentary. Well, it's not a new documentary. It's an old documentary. It's a 40-year-old documentary called A Poem is a Naked Person. It was directed by the legendary Les Blank, who died a couple of years back. His son executive produced this project, which was basically to have it remastered and brought out to the public. What they need, it's primarily, the film follows Leon Russell, who is an emerging rock artist back in the day when this was made in the 70s, and he wanted to have a documentary made about his work and this period of his life. So he reached out to Les Blank, and the two collaborate on this. The film turned out very different, and for many years Leon was not supporting the documentary, but he eventually came around. It took a few decades. It's currently playing at the Film Forum. It just opened up on Wednesday, the 1st of July, and then it's going to be there for a couple of weeks, and it's going to be all over the place. Criterion is distributing it, or Janus Films and Criterion, which are, you know, sibling companies. And so Harrod joined me, and also Les's frequent collaborator and assistant editor, Maureen Gosling, who was on this show not long ago when we did a segment devoted to the documentary This Ain't No Mouse Music. So she's back. Thank you, Maureen, for coming back on. So those are the segments. And because I'm sitting in a public plaza making a fool of myself, we're just going to jump right into the first segment. This is my conversation with indie film producer Mike Ryan. This is a new idea that doing this podcast, doing it from the set of a film while in production. And then what would be real neat is to kind of follow the film through its trajectory, assuming that something very unique doesn't happen along the way that sort of sabotages things, which I'm sure is not the case. And to kind of check in with it, maybe like, you know, whatever the premiere festival turns out to be, to its theatrical effect, that's the route you go, all that.
Sounds good.
So this could be like kind of an interesting case study.
Yes, that's great.
Mike Ryan. I don't know that we've met, even though it seems like we have some history that where paths have crossed.
Right,
In childhood. It's great meeting you.
Good meeting you.
So where does one begin? So, okay, well, let's talk about a little bit about this film. It's called Missing Girl,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And you had come out of what project before this?
Well, this is 2014, year 2014. This is June, early July, and this is the second film for me this year. So I just shot this year Free Indeed, Jake Mahaffey's film in Memphis. I think over a year ago, I think it was at the comedy premiere. I produced the comedy, and at BAM, I think I was introduced to Alex. And he told me he was a big fan of my films. He was a big fan of About Sunny, the comedy, the Todd Solondz films, and asked if I would read one of his scripts to try to make a film together. And I think one of the main things he was interested in was in working with actors, you know, talented actors. And, you know, that's my specialty in terms of selecting films and making films that are that give actors a real chance at flexing. You know, if there's one thing that I'm known for, it's that idea that I pick scripts that can give actors the ability to modulate the career. Amy Adams and June Bug being the obvious
mm-hmm.
example.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just casting. It's actually a pairing as well. It's a pairing a part with a particular person. You know.
Well, it has to start with the script.
Showcase them.
Yeah,
right,
it has
right,
to.
Course.
Yeah,
right,
with
right.
the script. The script that, you know, generally since we're making these films because they're real indies, they're not fake indies, they have to require very little money. And so the script has to really be focused on the plot tied to one character's journey.
Right. I see. That's your...
And that's how I get the actor, a high-quality actor,
sure.
to work for SAG Scale, because they see that it's an opportunity for them to dramatize a full human being, the full
right.
scope of the human experience.
And within that experience, to as you said, flex their muscle or showcase their talent.
Yes.
Right? And so it can be an investment also in their career.
Yes, that's the whole point. I make essentially what I make are awards films,
mm-hmm.
festival awards films, films that win actors and actresses awards. I've done it pretty consistently. I set out to do it with About Sunny, and we did it. We got a nomination for Lauren Ambrose on the Spirit Awards. And these are, it's just what I'm interested in. I come from a theater background. I'm interested in the actor. Combined with a director who has a very specific visual point of view. And is wanting to use film grammar in a unique way. Those combination, that's my sweet spot.
You mentioned the screenplay, and so just take one step back. You may get a screenplay. You can identify something that turns you on, which is that you know, it's about the trajectory of a character's emotional life on some level, right? Or it's telling an emotional story. And so you will then see, oh, well, now it's, you're filtering it through, right? And you're saying how much is it going to cost to make all this stuff, right, as the producer, potential producer of it. So you would then think, I'm going to sit with a screenwriter and say, maybe we want to modify some stuff, right, before we commit to doing this thing.
Yeah, but it's not driven by money. It's driven purely by the material. So when I first get the screenplay, I say, you know, this will make this character stronger if there's a scene in which she cries, or this will make it more attractive to an actor and actress if we also show them being courageous rather than fearful all the time.
Right. And is there confronting the drunk dad?
Yeah, but not just also in a Sid Fieldish way. It's a more holistic way that when I ask the question, then it won't be answered by just writing one scene. It will be answered five drafts later, which will then open up other characters, which will then open up. So over a year and a half, Alex and I worked on the script with me saying, maybe Fran is not just a cop who comes in to ask questions about what happened to the missing girl. You know, what happens if, again, because I want a real actress, mm-hmm. I want somebody strong, and nobody's going to come to act in a film in which they're just giving exposition. And I don't want a character who's in a film whose only role is to give exposition. So how do we make that character more significant? Well, she's got to enter into his life. How is she going to enter into his life? Well, we need to articulate that he needs her in his life, which then changes this, which mm-hmm. then changes that. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it was over a year of Alex and I opening the thing up. And again, my goal is to make as full human beings out of every role, because then I can get a lot of great actors in there. But it's also to make something that's dramatically more honest and significant.
How much of an uphill, I don't want to use the term battle, but how much of a chore is it to... These are the films that do win the awards in the end, I mean, generally, and get the praise and the critics and all that get behind the film and build a buzz are those films you're kind of describing, even though there seems to be endless number of other films, too, being made that don't offer that. So I'm just wondering, is there always a certain amount of resistance to really taking that year and working on it and trying to get it through all of the necessary rounds of the, you know, all 8-9 rounds? Or is it...
You're talking about the process of getting to the point where we're here on set from when it started?
Yeah, because it's also, as you say, you're working on the script, making it into a character study. And I don't know, it just seems that the industry is not... I don't know if they're valuing that. I don't know.
No, you're asking to justify the process and the time I put into it in terms of business. And there's no justification for mostly anything we do in the film section in terms of business. There really isn't. There was myths that there were. But and I do make a meager living at doing this, but myself and the investors that I work with are not, you know, there's a return that's beyond any numbers on a calculator. And it's a return for investors that ideally we would like to return money, and I would like to make a decent salary. But in reality, you know, this is nourishing in a different way. The process, I could not calculate. It's absurd, but everything in this business is absurd. It's not just absurd for me in terms of money terms. It's absurd for Harvey and for, you know, the studios, you know, in terms of what it is. Wall Street Journal did an article where I think they added up all the budgets of the films at Sundance 2012 and then compared it to the box office in 2013, and there was a 2% return on that initial mm-hmm. money, not 2% profit. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, I can't talk about it in terms of that. The reality, the logistical reality is that I often have 12 to 15 of these films in play at once. Mm-hmm. So some come to fruition, is that right? Some don't. Yeah.
Oh,
you know?
Okay. So you're walking into a fair number of screenplays, or I guess they're mostly screenplay format, right? You're getting them, obviously. And you're seeing the potential in them, and so you're developing them.
Yeah, I'm developing at least pretty much 12 at the same time. And it's difficult. It's very difficult for the filmmakers because, you know, one will grab velocity at different times. Suddenly an investor is involved or the lead actor comes on board, and then I have to find the money for it. And it's difficult. It's very difficult. It is utterly nonsensical.
But you have an office full of a buzzing office with like four or five assistants, right?
And no, you know, I have one assistant and I have interns and, you know, and the interns help me sort through the scripts. There's an enormous amount of scripts that come in from the agencies and from people and regular people. And it's and then I pursue my own things that I want to do, which is, you know, I option books or I option screenplays, not just screenplays, but people's life rights and pursue my own things. So I have my own screenplays being written from books that I've bought.
Right. Okay. So you commission them to a writer.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like I'll read a book and I know an investor is particularly a particular investor is into a particular subject. So I'll have him buy the book and then pay for the screenwriting process and get him on board early in terms of development. So there's for me, the development process, you know, the industry doesn't do it anymore because it's nonsensical from a money perspective. You know, the studios don't do it. There's no longer really any independent film companies in New York like there was. Good Machine's been gone now. I don't know how long. And they used to do development. Ann Carey used to run development. And there used to be, a person who would speak with writers every day. You know, it was a beautiful time. And that doesn't exist anymore. And I still work from that model or that concept.
Where are you based?
I'm in where I was born and raised, New York City. I'm in Queens, Long Island City, in the office right next to Silver Cup.
Oh, very nice. Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow, that's nice to almost has a kind of a charm to it now when everything else everybody's saying is Brooklyn. And
well, I was born and raised in Queens and Long Island City, and I live in Astoria. So.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So what created velocity with Missing Girl, and I don't know a lot about it because I chose this through our mutual friend Michael Taylor, who's the editor on the film and also edited About Sunny, that this was a nice ripe situation mm-hmm. to come in. Mm-hmm. So I've seen a little bit about it. It's about an emotionally stunted mm-hmm. middle-aged man mm-hmm. played by Robert Longstreet. Mm-hmm. I guess as you started setting it up before, there's a missing girl. That's a backstory, or rather, it's a subplot.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, this is another one of my man boy films. The comedy that I made was one. Mm-hmm. This phenomenon of the 40-year-old coming of age story,
yeah.
This is one of them. But Alex has made films before, and when I got this screenplay, there were various things in it that engaged me. But one of the main things that engages me, I'm not a very much into story, so to speak, or plot, overly plotted films. I'm a slow film guy, and I don't like overly plotted. What that specifically means is I don't believe in causality, the Western version of the idea of action and reaction leads to some sort of linear projection. And I just don't believe in that. I won't say I'm specifically Eastern in my philosophy, but action-reaction, which is the basis of Western plotting from Shakespeare on, I'm just not a fan of. And so with this, I became interested because we were able to bring that aspect of causality out of the equation in terms of the plotting. So we have a person who becomes infatuated with a young girl for specific emotional reasons. She, quote-unquote, disappears, but we see her just go to Brooklyn for an interview. And he creates this aspect of causality that she was kidnapped or she's the victim of this Lothario. And he creates this action-reaction detective plot, which we, from the beginning, know is not because we see her in Brooklyn having fun. But it's a factor of what I feel about a lot of Western plotting, which is a reflection of the need for people to organize the chaos. And so I just say, you know, why do you have to tell this story in which people are killed, in which there's redemption, in a kind of Campbell mythic way of trying to analyze? And so here we have this character creating this plot,
right.
And it's more like, why is he spinning his wheels? And then the film goes to answer that.
So you're deconstructing the Western idea of story, or story within the movie. This guy who's creating a fantasy, right,
mm-hmm.
In order to add structure to his life that will, you know, I don't know, will help him grow on some level.
Well, most importantly, what the plot is doing is allowing him to distract himself from the emotional issues in his life, which is his lack of intimacy, his inability to connect with other human beings, and his inability to face his utter depression in the sense of his utter mortality. And a lot of what goes on in America in terms of the entertainment business is about distraction. So plots, the Sid Field plot, is created to distract you from dealing with. I don't watch many Hollywood films, but when I watch them, I get stuck on this character. Like, what is his real problem? Like, why does he have to pick up a gun? And I start thinking about that. And Luc Besson has also, obviously, and done that same concept with some films. But so that's the thing, is like he's created plot in order to avoid his inability to deal with his own mortality, his father's mortality, and his own emotional lacking.
That's beautiful. So. But meanwhile, you get to have your cake and eat it too, because on the larger picture, your movie is also rubbing against that idea, and it goes more. So you were,
but at the same time, I don't like to trick the audience. I'm not a fan of suspense. Okay. So we eliminate suspense right from the beginning,
and let you know.
Yeah, there's no mystery about this girl.
She's not dead.
Right. She's not in peril. In fact, everybody who we think is going to be hurting her actually turns out to be decent guys.
Yeah.
And this kind of dastard, which she comments, she makes a meta comment to him, because she works in a comic book shop, but she's into independent comics.
Yeah.
He's into men in tights and superheroes. And he looks at her journal. She's drawing in a very indie style.
Right.
And he says, what is that about? What's going on there? And she says, oh, it's just about ordinary life. There's no men trying to take over the world.
And that part is played by the actress Alexia?
Alexia Rasmussen, yes. A great, talented actress that I've been lucky to work with several times.
I saw her recently in Proxy, but I don't think you produced that.
No, I did the comedy with her and Losers Take All, and last weekend, Tom Dolby's Last Weekend.
Okay.
Which will come out shortly. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I hadn't seen that. I was saying, wait a minute. If I could just go off on a little tangent, and that is, I'm going to guess that films like Robert Bresson, and Antonioni, which you mentioned before we started, had an impression on you.
Yeah, I mean, I was I went to high school in the West Village in the 70s, and I was a theater brat. I was a theater person, acted all through high school, only if really were involved in theater. And actually, the only times I went to the movies was Times Square with my father to see Bruce Lee or war movies. So I never had any real respect for the film medium. And in fact, the first film I really saw was in a college course, a silent film class. And it wasn't until then that I started to explore, and it was through European cinema where I saw that actually the film medium had something to say. And of course, my horizons were opened very quickly. And when I got out of college, because I quickly came to realize that I had misjudged the medium, because I was exposed only to typical American films, that I worked for the Bleecker Street Cinema as a projectionist in 1984. And at that time in Manhattan, we had all these rep theaters, the Thalia, the Metro, Theater 80.
Yeah.
And when you worked at one of them and were underpaid, you were able to go free to all the others. So I worked in the AG.
Like an ID card or something? Or they just knew
you were on a list.
Oh, you were.
Yeah.
On a list.
So all the workers, all the ticket takers, and all the projections were on a list. So I worked in the 16 millimeter room, which Sid Geffen started, which was called the AG room, which was a 16 millimeter projection room. And my first screening wasn't until 4. So I would be at 11 a.m. at the Metro Theater to the Buñuel, you know, the Godard. And so I got my education in the rep theaters.
Sure.
Just on all films, you know, and through Wim Wenders, then that was right around Paris, Texas. We did a retrospective of all of Wim's films at the Bleecker Street, and I had a lot of time with Wim, and I told him I was only into his European films, and he quickly turned me on to Nick Ray and onto genre and opened my eyes to Western. I'm a big Bud Bedecker fan because of Wim Wenders, and then, of course, reading you know, K.A. de Cinema and Andrew Saris, I then got into. So I came back to American genre through Wim Wenders telling me that I was pretentious and only wanting to be into European cinema and not being caring about American cinema. So I got my education that way. Yeah. I didn't go to undergrad film school. I eventually did go for writing and directing for graduate, but I kind of gave myself my own film education.
Right. And also there is a long history of European cinema being influenced by American cinema, and American cinema before that being influenced by European, right? The first most of the first generation of Hollywood directors were Europeans.
Through that path, that's how I got to Douglas Sirk. And then because I had already in high school, I had acted in Brecht plays, and I was a big Brecht fan all through. And Douglas Sirk started Brecht. You know, basically, Douglas Sirk's visual style is kind of a Brechtian distancing devices. You know, that he's using. He's refracting in a very Brechtian way American culture. And so I got heavily into Douglas Sirk, which then, of course, I was lucky enough to do Far From Heaven with Todd Haynes, where I was able to live with Todd to as location manager to try to make our own Douglas Sirk, which was a lot of fun. And so I came back around to the Americans through Europe in a weird way.
Sure. We were talking again before we started the podcast, but you were talking about there's a lot of things you can't really talk about it when it comes down to specific thoughts on the industry, right? And but you talk abroad, and we don't have to say much more about that. But I'm wondering, I guess, how that started.
Well, I mean, trying to raise money for these films, it's basically in 2008. I was making Life During Wartime in Puerto Rico, and we had a collapse, an economic collapse, and the following year nobody made films really. You know, it was very difficult. A lot of producers got out of the business, and then many others went on to say, okay, I've got to make comedies. That's what the market is. I've got to do. And I have no interest in comedies. I have no interest in romance in that way, in that sense. And I'm just not interested in just distraction as entertainment. So I decided to go the other way. In part, it was also a recognition that there was a reorganization in wealth going on, and that elite wealth has, I think that culture, as we look back on history, has produced some of the greatest artwork. Bach is directly connected to a very extreme, comfortable elite. And I do believe that when people get to a certain level financially, they can finally rest and realize what's valuable in life. Mm-hmm. is the most significant aspect of life is culture, and is basically art. It helps us to try to deal with life in a way that once you're past the distraction of earning money. And so I just kind of reconfigured my vision of what I was doing to be able to work in that space. Prior to that, we would chase Wall Street money or try to deal with banks and try to justify what we're doing purely in market terms. And some people are able to create that fiction and get that money. It's also tied to them, the product they create, which I'm not doing. So I had to find another way to reconfigure our perspective on what we're doing. I will say in America, there's three C words that should never be said or that people are afraid of, and that's cancer, communism, and culture. So I don't speak about it that much in terms of culture, but that's why I do get along in Europe a lot. I'm making two European films, the co-productions this year. I just have a different perspective on what I'm doing, and it's not really seeking market approval in that way. I'm seeking higher approval, and luckily I've had investors that are also engaged with this idea.
Mm-hmm. And when did this all ferment? When did this kind of come together?
It came together, well, specifically
for you. I mean,
for me,
when
well,
did you get it like this?
Well,
this
it was after 2008
doing.
When
yeah.
I,
oh,
you know,
the,
when
during
I said,
this very time you're talking
yeah,
about, yeah.
Was it, well, I either had to make Oops, I Farted, or I Like Your Girlfriend, mm-hmm. or go back and teach full time, or do something different. And I tried to, and I started talking to investors or potential investors. I really don't talk to, I don't deal with a lot of people who have made many movies. So I talk to a lot of people who are more engaged with culture that invest in the films. And so I started to basically, and also I just a lot of it was I just lost the ability to lie.
Yeah.
I made a film, June Bug, $750,000. and nominated for an Oscar. Sony Classics made a lot of money from it, although they will say, you know, they spent a lot of money in order to make that money. So actually, you know, one would say that not a lot of money was made. But at any rate, the investors were very angry that they never saw any return. And other investors would ask me, well, how much did you make from Junebug? It was nominated for an Oscar. And I just got tired of lying, you know. Mm-hmm. And so my approach is more about why I do this, why I invest so much of my time, and also about America and where we're at. The internet has really, unfortunately, deadened culture in many ways. It's not really expanded it. People have lost a lot of curiosity because of the internet. They've lost their ability to go on journeys in which the outcome is not known, because they're used to pushing a button. As soon as they feel that sense that they don't know where they're going, they just switch the channel or change to another website. And that impulse has really kind of made us, I think, a lesser culture. And so I'm just trying to widen the bandwidth of mm-hmm. options available. And there are a lot of investors who feel that way and that want to do it. And that's our purpose. We also try to make money, and we hope to make money, but I have to be realistic. And all you have to do, or your lawyer has to do, is 5 minutes of research, and that truth will be apparent.
How did Missing Girl, though, move into the front of the queue then?
Alex has a very... Alex, the writer-director, has a very unique relationship with various people in Connecticut, because he's made films in Connecticut. And he has a relationship with a studio here that's
a movie studio.
It's a studio. Sonalist Studios is one of the largest actual stages in Waterford, Connecticut, that was essentially built by the submarine industry, and it's they've had Pentagon contracts mm-hmm. to do submarines. They've been tied to the submarine business. Submarine manufacturing and doing, they repair sonar, they do all kinds of things that are connected to submarines, and they also do a lot of commercials. And they're very fantastic facility and helping us with a lot of in-kind costs, post-production and facilities and cameras, and their crew is super professional that's working on this. And so there was a lot of opportunities there for us to be able to make a high quality film for
keep
very
costs,
little
right,
equity
really yeah. low, and now was the opportunity to do it.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah, so it was basically Alex's connection to this filmmaking community in Connecticut that made it possible.
Right. You don't have to, at that point, Robert Longstreet, who is the lead actor in mm-hmm. it's a rare case where this is maybe a case in point where, as you were describing earlier, this is a guy who's a character actor for countless films in the last 10, 15 years. And here is a rare opportunity where he actually is a lead, because he just doesn't get a lot of those.
Yes, he's done the lead. Yes.
He built this niche, in other words.
Yes, he does. Yeah, but he's also been the lead in several films, like one Detonator, which was a film.
Right, I know it. Yeah, Detonator. Had the filmmakers on here.
Right. Damon Malucci was one of my interns for a while. Yeah.
Oh, is that right?
Okay. Yeah. And when he was at Columbia. And Cataclysm and
yes,
and but yeah, no, this is the situation. He gets offered films all the time, and he jumped at this because this is giving him you'll never think of Robert Longstreet the same way after this film, because his scenes with his mother, played by Shirley Knight, are really amazing. Yeah. And that's what we did. Alex and I wrote Alex wrote the part so that that was what we were going for, you know.
Was it written for Robert or
No, it was written for an actor who would die to be in this role, you know.
Well, that will have to, right? Yeah. So that actor, if he's listening, will just have to kind of wonder if it's him or not.
Yeah. But I mean, and all the roles, you know. So, but yeah, Robert Longstreet is a great actor who I think we'll be seeing more of, especially if he's asked me to help him get an agent. So he may be see him more in bigger films.
But if you look at his filmography, you'll see, you probably, if you're listening and you don't know his name, you've probably seen him in quite a few films.
Right.
I mean,
right.
If you're listening to this podcast, I assume you like independent films in the first place. Well, what the idea, I guess, is what we'll do is we'll keep in touch with the film as it goes through its paces, and I love that opportunity. And we're going to also have a do a few more segments over today with some of the other folks, including Robert. And,
great.
You know, I'm excited about it, and also very excited that I finally got to meet you.
Good to meet you.
And, yeah, hope to...
Yeah, so tracking the process is great. Here we are, the last 2 days of filming of a 20-day schedule in the wonderful village of New London, Connecticut, which has been like a backlot to us. It's been an amazing situation. Probably, this is actually my 32nd feature film. Not fully as producer. I was location manager for many years. And this is probably one of the most ideal situations I've had in terms of layout. We have so many locations, apartments, the comic book shop, police station, deli, restaurant, diner, and all of them have been walking distance to the hotel, which is walking distance to the production office.
Yeah.
In this little downtown village, which is packed with texture. Old 1879, this is the streets that Eugene O'Neill walked. This is the fog that comes in that Eugene O'Neill wrote about. The Dutch Tavern is where Eugene O'Neill drank, and it's in the same condition as it was when Eugene O'Neill worked, who's one of my gods, all through high school.
Yeah.
When I went to college, the first play that I staged was Huey. It's just been such a great time to be here in New London, but it's like a backlot. It's slightly abandoned.
Yeah.
And it's, one would say, dilapidated, but it actually has the texture that cinema loves, the texture that's no longer in New York City, the texture that's been banished by Bloomberg in Manhattan. And it's brick against clapboard, against buildings that... are still functioning, that have soul, but are exactly in the same condition they were in the 1800s and the 1920s.
It's refreshing.
It's great.
Yeah.
You know, and you should see it at night when the fog rolls in, because we're right here by the water, and these weird incandescent lights that they have. It's just been a joy to be here. Mm-hmm. It's really been great.
So thank you to the town or city of New London.
Town, yeah.
Yeah, I love this kind of town, and there's a something of a, I guess also negative side in terms of it's gone through difficult days,
right?
You know, but
you know what? It's going to come back, because that's part of what our film is about. Also, is that if you see where our comic book shop, all of those spaces that we rented two empty spaces. The rest of the spaces are rented by bands and artists, and this whole downtown is filled with artists, young kids who don't have parents to pay for them to be in Brooklyn, and who are working off their debt from UConn, but still want to paint and create music.
Yeah.
And they will be, the elders of this town will recognize it soon enough, but they are the future of, because eventually they're going to have retail needs, and those needs have got to be met. And eventually all these empty stores will be full with things for them. But they're here now, and they may seem like the long-haired, tattooed, ratty bunch, but ironically, they're the future of a town like this.
Well, thank you very much for giving me your time, and you'll come back again.
Yes.
Actually.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks. All right.
Again, we'll let you know exactly what's going on with The Missing Girl step by step. I'm going to follow the film right through distribution, the festivals, distribution, theatrical, on-demand, blah, blah, blah. That was the idea, and that's what we're going to do. And I have the full-fledged support of the team behind this film to continue doing it, so I'm very grateful to everybody there. Next up, we're going to have Ryan Miller. Here's more music by Guster, and then we'll hear from Ryan.
How are you, Ryan?
Hello. How are you?
All right. It's so nice to meet. I guess, is this considered meeting each other?
There's some version of meeting going on, yes.
I'm delighted. You know, when they proposed this, you know, where they said, "Do you want to? Would you like to talk to Ryan Miller of Guster?" And I was like, yeah, that would be." I was pretty excited, actually.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I've been a fan, it so happens. I mean, for years, have, you know, a number of albums, and so it was just a perfect opportunity.
Although you do know there is some film stuff in my life, right?
I do. In fact, I think I've seen...
Okay, cool.
And I was going to get to that. This is a perfect synergy in that way, because you've actually...
Right.
We'll talk about those films, too. As well as the new album, but did you score them, or was it, did you write songs for those films?
No songs, all scoring.
Okay. Was that something that you had always wanted to do as a musician, or did it just sort of come about at some point, it was presented to you, and then you jumped at it?
Well, no, I mean, I think I had always sort of thought that, you know, eventually I was going to have to find another job. As a musician, I didn't really think that I was going to be able to spend my ride around on a tour bus and playing music with my friends. And so there's always sort of a thought, I think, in every musician, touring musician, of, you know, how it's going to work. Am I going to raise my family? And so I had sort of poked around early on with, I looked at sort of the commercial world and how does that work, and was sort of intimidated by that whole process because those guys were so good at what they did. And just sort of as a goof, my buddy and I wrote a movie. I don't know, I should figure out when this was, probably like 5-6 years ago or something. Mm. And it was called Nobody, and it was independent finance. I just thought I wanted to musically supervise it. I didn't even know what that meant. And then when I got into it, he was like, "Well, you should just score it." And I didn't know what that meant either. But I think I just kind of started doing it, and I had this kind of light bulb moment of, "Oh, wow, this is super fun. And maybe this is what I can do for the rest of my life." And ever since then, I sort of became very, you know, aggressively going after this composer world and trying to get work and trying to learn how to do it. And, you know, I had a really early success. I got really lucky with a film really early on, and it kind of helped launch my scoring career. Yeah, it wasn't really something I had always wanted to do, but once I figured out what it was and that I loved it, then it became something I was very aggressive about.
I could see why. And it's such a different, yet obviously I would imagine, and I could be completely wrong. I mean, it's collaborative. They're both are collaborative, right? Obviously playing in a band is very collaborative, even if you're maybe the primary writer, I don't know. And then working on a film, you're doing a lot of that work, I don't know, maybe on your own and then presenting it. I'm sure each film might be different. Maybe each film is different.
I mean, the main difference is that in a film, it's a huge ego check, because I'm not the boss anymore. In the band,
right?
You know, obvious. I mean, I am. I'm not really the boss of my band. I have, you know, collaborators and bandmates that I've been playing with, and I kind of have to go through them. But it's kind of our thing, and I get a big vote as sort of the lead singer. And
right.
In a film, it really has very little to do with what I think. You know, I can sort of make a case for certain things, but it's you know, I kind of give a speech before every job and say, just so you know, I get this. If you're not happy, I'm not happy. And you become much more of a craftsman, and you're in the service industry all of a sudden. So it's a completely different state of, you know, you're in a different, it's just a different way of sort of being an artist, because you're in service of somebody else's vision rather than your own. Basically,
yeah.
What it boils down to.
But I imagine that also has its upside too. It must be a double-edged sword, because then you're off the hook. I mean, you know, there's got to be a lot of pressure being at least perceived as the front guy in a band. I mean, it's obviously not Ryan Miller and Guster by any stretch, but I don't know. I would imagine maybe that's part of the appeal for you to composing, is that it's just, there's you know, you're for hire, as you said it yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it's not something, you know, it takes probably, you know, 3 years to make a movie. You got to write it, you got to find financing, you got to, you know, get your team together, you got to shoot it, you're in post forever, and so filmmakers don't get to make that many movies, but composers can do multiple movies a year. You know, some composers do multiple movies at once. So it's different in that sense. But, you know, also, we've been really lucky, and I've worked with a lot of great directors in a very short amount of time. You know, my first real one ever was The Safety Not Guaranteed, which, you know, kind of crushed at Sundance, and Colin just wrote and directed Jurassic World, which had the biggest opening of any movie in the history of man, you know.
Yeah,
so, like,
it's,
you
pretty
know,
amazing.
I have a relationship with Colin, and Lake Bell, who did In the World, and Jordan Vogt-Roberts, who did Kings of Summer, is now writing King Kong, and so I've been able, really lucky to work with some people really, you know, really early in my career that are great relationships and, you know, will keep doing great things.
Well, you know, we have some friends in common then, because, well, first of all, Jordan was on this podcast with Kings of Summer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I interviewed him.
Oh, yeah.
We had a great time.
Oh, that's cool.
He's a sweet guy.
Yeah, he's awesome.
And also Todd Rohal.
Oh, yeah. That was a really fucked up one, though.
I know.
Todd got.
I know.
That was a really,
he's
really
scarred.
Bad situation.
Yeah. Yeah, he was pretty scarred from that experience.
Yeah, he was a really, and we kind of came in at the very end of that, and pretty much everything that could have gone wrong did on every level, and he's such a great guy, and that movie just, like, it was a really good experience for me to kind of see the bad part of filmmaking. You know, I kind of got lucky with Safety, and I had a great experience on Kings of Summer with Jordan, and had a really good experience with Lake, and then worked with, you know, a lot of those were beachside movies, so when they put me on this, we basically had 2.5 weeks to do the score, Eric Johnson and I, and just kind of getting the sense of, from Todd, what was happening. It's like, oh my God, what a nightmare, dude, I'm so sorry, you know, and I was trying to do what I was supposed to do, and also trying to make him happy, and it was, you know, it was quick, and I learned a lot. But yeah, that's just like, it's so hard to make a movie, and that's one of those, you know, it's easy to say that, but then it's like, oh, right, this is my part. You know, that
sure.
was probably one of the most fucked up film situations I've ever, like, been part of. You
well,
know?
You'll be glad to know he's rebound, and he's fine. And are you familiar with BAM here in Brooklyn? Have you played at BAM?
Yeah, we've done something at BAM, and I've seen movies and stuff there.
Oh, very good. Because Todd's movie, his new movie, which is this outrageous comedy called Uncle Kent 2, it's going to be at BAM Cinema Fest, which just started last night, and which is a very prestigious annual indie film showcase, taking kind of the best of the year there. And his new movie.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so he's in that.
Bob?
So I saw him. He was also, I just did a recent episode with him, too. I keep getting promoting myself here. I apologize. But I guess what I would like, I would love it if you listen to a couple of those, maybe the one with Jordan and with Todd, and, you know, just to see what you think of that stuff. But
I'd love to hear Todd's take on it. And Jordan's a hilarious, too.
I never really put him on the record with that film, with that one we've been talking about, because, you know, I know he probably just, it would put him, you know, it may make him uncomfortable. But we had one long evening a couple of summers ago where he told me the horrid details and all that, you know. Anyway, but to get back to your music, I don't know who turned me on to Guster, but the whole sensibility, I like the, you know, they're very catchy, good hooks. The vibe of the band is wonderful. Your songwriting is really good. You know, and your voice, it's such a distinctive sound. Did you always sing? Or did you just kind of get, maybe you were the best singer in the group? How did you end up being a singer?
No, actually. I mean, you know, it's funny, when we started out of our dorm rooms in 1991.
Did you all go to college together?
Yeah, we all went to school together in Boston at Tufts University. And
okay.
Adam, he was the singer of his high school band, and he was already, like, in the singing group at our school, which was, believe it or not, kind of a big deal. So he was always sort of going to be the singer, and then it just sort of so happened as we were writing and stuff, he was like, oh, you can sing, you should sing. And I was like, okay, so it really started with him sort of being the guy, and then as sort of time developed, it just it turned into one of those things where I was writing a lot of the melodies, so when it would be kind of hard to pass over. They're like, hey, sing these songs of mine, you know. So I ended up kind of becoming more of the singer over time. But no, it's not something I ever did. I was in a band in high school and never sang or anything like that. It came very late.
Were you did you what did you, how early on did you learn guitar?
I guess I was playing. You know, I was playing instruments in junior high and high school, but never. I was never going to be a shredder, and I was never. You know, I was always in the service of song. Always, I never wanted to. You know, I took piano lessons, but I was also playing with, like, you know, my Apple TV had a MIDI setup on it, so I was playing keyboards really early on, and I was never going to be like a musician in terms of, like, oh, I can go jam. Like, I was never going to jam, and it was always kind of, for me, more about songwriting. So I was focused on that really early on.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Texas.
Okay.
In Dallas.
Were your parents into music? Did you grow up in a house with music playing a lot?
No, but I was an only child, and I was sort of, like, indulged, you know. So when I wanted to get a guitar or a keyboard, they were kind of, that stuff was sort of there for me. But I think my grandma might have had some musical stuff in her, but it was never, you know, I didn't grow up with it, like, you know. I grew up with records around and stuff, and was really into music from a really young age, but not sort of from my parents.
What did you go to? What part of Texas?
In Dallas.
Oh, Dallas. Maybe you said that. I'm sorry. And then did you have, like, I don't know, did you first get interested in college radio? Was that really kind of the first?
No, actually, it kind of got me. I mean, I was really listening to shitty metal, like, way longer than it was fashionable. I remember, like, the kids were like, man, everybody else listen to bullshit. We're listening to Motley Crue still. So, like, I just had really bad taste and no other older brother. And a thing that kind of saved my life was Dallas had one of the first alternative radio stations in the country. So they were one of the first, you know, stations to play The Cure and The Smiths and New Order and Depeche Mode. And so that was sort of when I first started listening to music, you know, that of any note. And then when I got to college, I had to play catch up because I had never listened to, you know, the Velvet Underground or the Beach Boys or the Beatles or Marvin Gaye or Ben, really anything. You know, I didn't have much of I just didn't know much about music going in. I knew a lot about alternative music and that was pretty much it. So, you know, it has a lot to do with why our first records, I feel like, were sort of less good than our other ones. I just didn't know that much about, you know, songwriting at that point.
Makes sense. And then you guys, you said you all met at the Tufts, right? And then were you just starting to perform locally? I mean, what was the transition to becoming a recording and touring band? How long did that transition take?
Well, it was pretty much like college was training, was basically functioned as training wheels for the band. You know, we got started, we met really early in college, like first day of school, and we kind of formed this half-assed band really early on, and, you know, made a record with a local producer, you know, our junior year. So by the time we graduated, and that whole time we, you know, we would start playing on campus, and then we played our first ever off-campus party at Harvard, and then we, like, played at a shitty bar in Harvard Square, and then we started playing the Paradise, and so it was just a very organic, you know, we were playing on the streets of Boston, like, kind of with our guitar cases out, you know, like, busking for a long time. Yeah, that was a huge part of us kind of learning how to play, and it just kind of started like that, and sitting in Boston ended up being really fortuitous because it was one of those things where kids would go to school in Boston and then go home for the summer and bring our music with them and kind of, like, seeded, like, oh, these guys live in New Jersey, but they were going to school in Boston and they live in Chicago. So it really kind of emanated out from the Boston college situation.
Mm-hmm.
So we just kind of, you know, we played we just basically got in the van after we graduated and started touring and sleeping on people's couches and, you know, trying to make fans sort of one at a time.
You booked yourself.
Yeah, everything. We booked ourselves. We didn't have a record label. We didn't have a real manager. We didn't have anything. We didn't have a lawyer. We just basically, you know, we just kind of got in the van and started touring and kind of got looped in with the jam band scene because we were playing in the same clubs, even though we didn't know how to jam and weren't really improvising. And then, things started, and at some point we were, you know, selling out Irving Plaza in New York City. And I think that's kind of when the record labels started paying attention. And then that's kind of when we got our manager, who's a buddy of ours, and the whole thing kind of all came out of the touring situation.
Wow. It sounds like such a, earnest and organic, as you use that word, real applies. It's like there's this, you know, it's such a positive sounding story. It's like, you know, four guys who just earnestly want to make good music together, work hard, get discovered, and then become a popular, you know, label signed band.
Yeah, this is all pre-internet too. You know, we didn't have email addresses, we didn't have mobile phones. So we were, you know, when I say DIY, it was, you know, very much us printing out newsletters on our dot matrix printer, and you know, it was very much a really like kind of, not that it was like, you know, tough times or anything, but it was definitely, yeah, you know,
grassroots.
A lot of the stuff that makes that stuff a lot easier today just didn't exist for us.
Yeah, well, the grassroots. It was grassroots.
Yeah.
Where did the name Guster come from? How did you choose the name Guster? I love learning all this stuff.
I don't actually. We were called Gus, and then we just needed a name, and I didn't know I was going to be 42, still playing in the same band with that dumb name.
I like it, though. People ask me the same question. The name of my show is Film Wax Radio. Film, you know, and people say, where did Film Wax? I had to make up an idea after. I just came up with it arbitrarily. It's just there's no exciting backstory, I'm afraid, either, you know.
Yeah, usually I just lie and I make up a new story every time.
Exactly. Yes. Well, let's get to just mention a couple of things that are coming up. By the way, you're going to be playing Summer Stage here in New York anyway, even though people all over, I hope, are listening. You'll play Summer Stage on July 20th. I got to come. You know, as much as I've listened to your albums, including, by the way, the new one, which is called Evermotion, right?
Evermotion.
I've never seen you guys play live. And all those sold-out shows at Irving Plaza. I even lived down the block on 15th Street, and I didn't see you guys.
Yeah, there. Really?
Yeah.
So, where do you live, on 16th Street?
Yeah, so I lived on East 15th Street right by Union Square for years. And so I would go to Irving Plaza all the time.
Yeah, that was my first apartment in New York, was on 17th and 2nd.
Oh, really? So we were like neighbors.
Yeah.
What years was that? Can I ask?
We were almost neighbors. That was 90. I was only in that apartment from 99 to 2000.
Yeah, exact same period of time. I lived on 15th and 3rd Avenue, right by that Con Ed building.
Yeah.
From 93 to 2000. Yeah, about 7-8 years, right there, right around the corner from you.
Wow, you're living in New York in 93, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah, I was.
Yeah,
yeah, no,
cool.
I moved into Manhattan. I was living in Brooklyn before that, but I lived in Manhattan from like 92 till about 2002 or 3. I forget exactly.
Wow. I always have fantasies of that era of the late 80s of, you know, that I missed. I think I just missed where it was like Alphabet City, and it was like a lot of like, some of the squats and all that. So I'm very fascinated with that era of New York.
Yeah, no, I am. I know there's a kind of a romance or a mythology around the more, you know, grungier days of the East Village and the whole scene. And it was such an underground art scene there for so many years, right?
Yeah, and I especially now sort of seeing what happened to New York, even just on my watch, and how pricey and how, you know, how much it's changed. And I'm not going to sit here and say it was better. You know, like New York has been a dynamic animal since its inception, but it just seems like it was a really interesting era, and so much cool stuff came out of that time. And obviously there was murderers, and, you know, it wasn't all sunshines and happiness, but it seems like a really interesting time to be there.
The murderers, though, were hipper than they are now.
Yeah.
No, that's, no. But the thing, you know, like even earlier today, Ryan, I was over on the Bowery. I met with this filmmaker, James Ponsalt, who maybe you know about. He has a new movie.
I actually know James.
Yeah, he's a really sweet guy, isn't he?
Great guy.
Yeah, he's got this new movie called The End of the Tour, which is in the same festival that Todd's film is in. He opened it. So I met with him today for the podcast, and the movie is actually coming out at the end of July, but, you know, he was in town, so I got to talk to him. And it was at the Bowery Hotel, and it's like, it, you know, going to bed, just referring to what you just said, the idea of, like, in this place are these really wealthy people hanging out. And no offense, good for them. Don't get me wrong. It's nothing to do with that. But it's more just the geography that I'm referring to, like the idea that people are buying these, you know, $10 lattes on the same street where, like you said, in the 80s, whereas, you know, kind of pretty questionable area. I mean, it was, you know, it was the Bowery.
Yeah, I mean, the Bowery stuff is really interesting, obviously, because the CD thing is, like, steps away from Bowery Hotel. But then even now, you know, even now with the Bushwick and the way that things are sort of, that rents for storefronts and, like, Bushwick are more than the Lower East Side, and how quickly the Williamsburg thing happened. Just, it's so fascinating to me. And as a sort of as someone that actually really got pushed out in New York, I mean, I was living in Cobble Hill with my wife, and we had a second kid, and we were like, we couldn't afford a 3-bedroom. You know, we literally were just like, okay, well then we got priced out of New York in this very real way. And obviously you can make it happen, but it was just like, it isn't going to happen in a way that is going to work for us. So it's been interesting, and sort of watching, you know, all of my sort of generation and my friends, the ones that have managed to stay and the ones that have to camp for the burbs or some fucked up place like Vermont, like me, or LA or something. So it's, you know, I'm really, it's really, really interesting to me. And it was such a huge part of my life. And, you know, it becomes less so more and more, especially with the film stuff really centered in LA. I spend so much of my time there now that I'm not on the road. But yeah, it's really interesting to me. It's been a really interesting time to have a bear witness to New York's transitions.
Wow, I didn't realize that was such a substantial part of your adult life, New York. But
yeah, I mean, we were living in Boston together in a house, and then, you know, I guess it was when we were like in our mid to late 20s, we all moved to New York, and, you know, I was there for 12 years, and that was, you know, through your 30s is pretty substantial, you know, it's pretty big chunk of who, you know, who you are and who you've become and all that. Yeah,
absolutely.
It was a really great place to be, though. Really fantastic. And I'm sure it's still a great place to be in a lot of ways.
It is. But like you, I got priced. But like you, I got priced out. I just haven't left yet. That's the problem.
Yeah, I know those people, too. You know, there's people that can hang on, but I didn't have a partner. You have to have two people that are really willing to do it. And my wife, she, you know, New York will eat you if you're not ready to sign it. You know, if you don't have your dukes up, it'll just completely demolish you. And my wife just didn't have that fight in her, just wasn't interested. So that was a lost battle from the beginning.
And where are you guys based now?
I live in Vermont.
I thought I heard you say that. Where about?
Yeah, no, it's not. Yeah, it's not the usual thing. My wife's from here, and I had sort of advocated for, you know, Austin or Asheville or Nashville or L.A. or, you know, Portland. But she kind of had her sights set on this, and I'm gone so much that I felt like it wasn't going to be right for me to sort of, you know, force her to be somewhere where she didn't want to be. And so it's worked out really well, though. You know, it's beautiful here, and there's a good community, and it's really easy, and I can still leave a bunch and get the things that I need to get.
Well, can I ask what part of Vermont are you guys in? What part?
Yeah, I'm in just outside of Burlington.
Sure. I spent many, many summers up there in that area going
to
the summer camp that I worked at. Yeah, beautiful.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's a beautiful place.
Well, listen, maybe I can somehow wrangle, get into this concert over at Summer Stage next month. I would love to see you guys play.
Yeah, please.
I know you're headed towards Michigan, tomorrow, for the Travis City
Wine.
Yeah, by the time this is out, it'll probably be after the fact. But you're on tour, and you'll be in New York at least on July 20th for at Summer Stage with Kishibashi opening act. I see she's touring with you guys. Very good. Okay. I'll put a link to the whole schedule so people can find out where you know. And
awesome.
and I listened to the album, you know, again, it's on my iPhone, and where it will probably remain for quite a bit of time. So
awesome.
So please keep making albums.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Well, so far so good. So we felt like we could do another if we want to. So we'll see how it goes.
I'll put some music on this episode so people can hear little clips from some of the new songs. And all right, terrific. Thanks so much, man.
Absolutely. You have a great day. Thanks for talking to me.
Oh, thank you.
That's great. Last up here, again, is the creative team behind Les Blank's documentary, finally out 40 years later. It's called A Poem is a Naked Person. It's a gorgeous film with fantastic music and other characters. It's just a beautiful, tribute to art making. And it's such a little snapshot of its time. And this was a great conversation with Harrod Blank, executive producer of the film, and Maureen Gosling, who was an assistant editor. And I know she did more. I think she did some sound. So here it is, Harrod and Maureen.
But this deal out here is just kind of a floating mental hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for succumbing to this interview. Appreciate it.
Sure. I thought you were in L.A. I didn't even know you were going to be in New York.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm here. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, I always feel a little bit also like I don't want to. First thing I usually say is I apologize for contacting somebody outside of normal protocols. And then it's, I know.
Whatever.
But yeah, of course. So where are you based, by the way?
I'm in Berkeley part-time and Douglas, Arizona part-time.
Okay.
I was actually in Douglas, and then Les got sick, and I moved back to Berkeley to help deal with him. And then after his death, I kind of filled his footsteps. I became Les Jr.
Understood. Yeah, I understand. I'm in that stage myself, but with the parent.
It's good. It's all good. I'm doing what's the best I can do.
Well, as far as this film, which is called A Poem as a Naked Person, it seems like you're doing it real well. This is a great project, and thank goodness. And we're joined here by Maureen Gosling, who is a longtime collaborator and friend of Les Blank's for many years, many decades now, and his son, Harrod Blank, who's the executive producer of this project. You were an assistant editor on this documentary, too?
I was sound recordist and assistant editor.
Oh, okay, very good. Yeah, again, apologize. Like, I think I was just circulating mics last time I got together with Maureen because there was about four of us there that day, right? There was your...
Chris
Simon.
And me. And Jim Brown.
And Jim Brown was there too, yeah, the distributor. Okay, this is, you know, stuff that you probably talk about a lot, but it's kind of going to still be very interesting, I think, to anybody who is interested in the film or has seen it or wants to see it. So... The film was made right after this New Orleans shooting period, right, where two films came out of that, more or less.
It was actually in Cajun Country, in Black French Louisiana.
Very good.
Yeah, out in the countryside.
And it he probably goes down to, like, with one idea and then comes back with tons of stuff and tons of inspiration, right? Did he go down there to shoot Clifton Chenier and the Chenier family? Or
yes, he went to shoot Clifton Chenier as well as the other some of the other well-known Creole musicians, Creole music. Particularly Boisec Ardoin and Kenry Fontenot.
Okay. Oh, right. Very, very good. Actually, it's Leon who wants a documentary made about like a tour or his this period of his is his professional life. Correct.
Yes.
And so he goes to AFI in L.A. and says, who do you recommend? And they said, well, there's this young guy, Les Blank, who likes to make music docs. We recommend him. And so he didn't know what kind of what he's getting into. Is basically.
Right. I don't think so, totally. He may have seen, Denny Cordell and Leon may have seen mm-hmm. The Blues According to Lightning Hopkins. That's what Herod has heard. But beyond that, mm-hmm. they didn't really know what to expect. And we didn't know who Leon was either, so...
Well, he's very young at the time, right? Just kind of starting to grow out of the Oklahoma and this. And the
he had just been in Mad Dogs and Englishmen with Joe Cocker, and there was a film that came out in addition to the tour, and so that's where people said, oh my goodness, who's this guy Leon Russell? He was very impressive. He just kind of stood out with his white hair and his rockin' piano. So suddenly we had to learn who Leon was, and we realized, oh my God, this guy's a big rock star.
Yeah, and a very compelling subject, right? And where were you at the time? How old were you at that? What would you have been in?
In 1974?
Yeah.
I was 11, so I went there when I was 9 or 10. So I went to the lake to visit Les for the summer. I think it must have been 73 or 70, 73. So 1973, the summer of... Uh-huh. I was there, and during that time, Les wasn't filming, so I never saw him shooting anything, but I did see him swimming, and he may have been editing. I'm not sure if he was editing then or not. I never remember the editing machine, but I remember the catfish, and there was a lot of catfishing going on, and Les loved catfish, and I remember the lake, I remember the swimming pool, I remember the scorpions. I was fascinated by the scorpions.
Of course.
The pool was white at that time, so they must have painted it. Jim Franklin must have painted it after I was there, which I don't know how that timeline works. But
I see. Right. Well, you're referencing the fact that what started off as a Leon Russell documentary ended up being something I don't know if bigger, but more elaborate. Let's put it that way in terms of like following a number of different storylines or threads in the film, and one is this painter Jim
Franklin
who. Yeah. Made murals, basically, other than being maybe a traditional painter, but he, one of his canvases that we witness is this empty swimming pool.
Well, what I heard Jim Franklin tell was that Leon met Jim in Austin and was moved by his paintings and invited him to go to Tulsa to paint the recording studio.
Okay.
And then Leon went on tour and left Les and Maureen and Jim Franklin and a bunch of other people there. Uh-huh. At this lake property, and Jim didn't know what else to do, and he saw this swimming pool, and he said, there's a nice canvas. It was all white.
Well, it is, yeah.
And
yeah.
He started doing that on his own accord.
I see. Oh, okay.
And Les did things on his own accord.
Yeah, that's what happens.
And filmed what he wanted to film, and that's how you get this very interesting mix. It's almost an ensemble of some way of different artists and musicians. And,
yeah. Sure, it is.
Including Leon. Of course, Leon's the main center point of all of this, but the periphery that makes up this world is all so interesting and so Oklahoma and some Texas.
Yeah, but it's a montage of different things going on, which is interesting because, you know, that was something that was done more in narrative films, it seems to me. And one of the questions further down my list, but maybe it makes sense now to ask you both, your reaction is, what did Les Blank... I mean, really, what was he like? Kind of known for as pioneer documentary filmmaker. You know, I think the form of the personal documentary was still relatively young. It may have been out for a few years. There was a few guys making films, a few ladies too, but not many. So, what was that kind of unique about him?
Well, the first time I saw his films, I just thought they were incredibly poetic. Mm-hmm. And the more I hung around him and worked with him, I realized that he totally did everything by feeling. He based everything that he did when he shot what he felt like shooting, what moved him.
Yes.
I mean, that's what he shot the best. Sometimes he had to shoot things, and if he didn't feel like it, you could see it in the work. It wasn't as inspired as the other stuff. Mm-hmm. He also edited that way. I think he started that form with the Lightning Hopkins film, The Blues According to Lightning Hopkins, which was totally based on stream of consciousness, feeling connections between scenes, the feeling of the music, anything that was expressive in some way of a person, a moment. And he always looked for that with his camera when he was shooting. And then in the editing, I think the one thing that is really special about the Leon Russell film is that it's sort of the ultimate stream of consciousness work that Les did. And he had sort of a total, playpen of toys and images that he just gathered over the time that we were there and figured out how to use them and put them together in a way that nobody would have ever imagined. Leon certainly didn't have a clue that this guy was going to do this.
Well, yeah, I'm going to ask you about
that.
I'm wondering if Les, if he had an internal sense of editing as he went along, or if he was just going with the flow completely.
He had any foresight as how he was going to put a film together.
Yeah, okay.
Kind of came together.
Honest answer. Yeah.
In the process of editing. But going back to your last question, I remember Les saying that the Lightning Hopkins film, he had first started putting together much like one of his industrials with narration, mm-hmm. which he called insipid narration for these industrials.
Yes.
And he was just very disappointed. And he decided right then that he was going to throw out that narration
right.
forever. And so that was interesting. So he kind of learned that with the Lightning film. And the other thing that you were saying, Morgan was just saying, which I think is really true about him feeling things, I just recently saw some footage that was shot of Les working on the Burning Man film that I'm supposed to make one day. And this guy followed Les around and just watched him film. And you'd see Les holding the camera, and he's just walking around. He almost looks kind of depressed, but he just walks around looking and looking and looking and looking, and then he sees something, and then he goes into shoot mode, and he winds up the bell and howl, and he tries to, you can see him visualizing his mind how he's going to shoot it, and then he starts to shoot it, and there's this one thing he was shooting and somebody got in the way, and he's like, God damn it, because you only get, when you wind up a bell and howl, you only get you can only roll as long as your wind is, and this guy interrupted the shot. And so I was like, that's the kind of stuff we don't know about
sure.
with Les, is right. all the stuff that didn't work behind the scenes of like the Leon film or the Lightning film and the outtakes and the stuff that didn't make it.
So this was also during the 70s?
Burning Man thing is very recent. It was in 2005.
When he was kind of walking around.
When he was filming. I just learned something from watching
right.
that
sure.
it didn't come that easy. Not every shot is great.
Oh, I don't know. I would imagine anybody to the idea that what he was doing was easy, because it seems like he probably was ridden with anxiety when he's walking around like am I going to get anything?
And he would get upset at himself if he didn't feel it. Mm-hmm. If he wasn't feeling it, he would get depressed.
Yeah,
and then he would go drink, and then sometimes it would come to him, and then he would go shoot. But it's kind of like writer's block. Probably for Les when he could not figure out what to shoot.
Yeah, sure.
It really drove him nuts.
Well, that style of filmmaking, it seems especially to be like you got a puzzle on your hands, and like you at some point or other maybe you can figure it out. You figure it out like finally, like just when you're about to give up on what is this? What am I doing? What am I making here? What's this about? However you pose the question, at a certain point maybe finally that kicks in. Whether or not you feel confident about something eventually kicking in from experience or not is, I don't know. You think that if you've made enough films, you'll figure it out and you can just relax a little bit.
I don't know how much he relaxed. I mean, he seemed, there's a lot of anxiety.
Yeah, there's a lot of anxiety.
In every film.
You mentioned drinking. I don't know if it was a problem, but you mentioned that as a way of dealing with a certain amount of anxiety, at least in that moment during that film. I'm wondering if, because what I read about was Leon Russell and him being kind of a complicated figure and maybe, difficult, I don't know. What about Les? Like, it seemed from what I read also, that by the end, Leon was not really supporting the film. It wasn't what he envisioned, what he wanted when he walked into AFI that day or called them up. During the production itself, though, do we know, well, you probably know, Maureen, because about their relationship and who was the more difficult of the two?
Well, I'm just curious, pretty close.
Yeah.
Both of them were in their own ways.
Yeah.
I have some letters that I wrote to my parents during that time period, and I do have a record of, like, showing dailies, and there were a couple times when they sort of kicked us off the bus, and weren't sure if we were going to keep doing the film, but then we would show them dailies or a cut, and then we would be kept on. They decide that they like what we were doing. So I do have something, a letter that said that Denny for sure really liked the film at the end, and maybe Leon. I mean, it was enough for them to agree to submit the film to the Cannes Film Festival, but it didn't make it there because of the lost print.
I wanted to get that's a pretty dramatic story.
But then we don't know exactly what transpired after that to keep it from being seen at all. But I mean, Jim Franklin was even working on a press kit at that point, and so they were that far along. So we don't really know the details of what happened, and I don't even know if Leon can remember. At least that's what he said the last time.
Well, it has been 40 years. Can't blame anybody. Maureen, you're getting to this other really... Well, it's why in 2015 we're finally getting to see a poem as a naked person, because it was supposed to have its world premiere at Cannes. 74? 73? 74.
74,
mm-hmm. Correct? Yeah. And no print shows up. It was so it didn't get lost.
Late.
It was just late, and it didn't make it for its premiere.
The print was late, doing a big film festival, you need to have the print in advance to make sure that everything's going to work out.
So
when they didn't get the print on time, they nixed it.
Oh, okay.
And then this year I reached out to Cannes and said, well, why don't you
take
this up now, because we have the film. I never heard back from them.
Huh.
There's probably a lot of people that could have helped, but... maybe email is not the most reliable form of communication, but I didn't have any real contact. I did try.
I'm sure. Well, you know, it's not Cannes necessarily, but South by Southwest is in Austin. There is a history of that connection with the film, too, because of Jim, mm-hmm. right, the painter,
and Leon.
Spent a lot of time in okay, and certainly there were appreciative audiences, I'm sure, at the premiere, mm-hmm. right? So it took 41 years to finally get a finished film to a world premiere. That's an incredible story. And while Les may not have been around to see it, what was the final, where was the film at around towards the end?
Les did show a version at Pixar.
Yeah. Really?
Right before he died, like 3 months before he died, and gave a really elaborate Q&A. And it was very moving. It was a beautiful... it was a beautiful show. It was from a digibeta tape, so the quality wasn't that great.
Hmm.
But it was still the movie, and it was a full house. So that was the last time he showed it, and then he already knew that we had made contact with Leon. So he was very pleased with that. He knew that communication had been established, and that I was going to try my best to get it released. So he knew.
The film is about a very exciting time in rock and roll. I mean, it's just, you know, where there was a looseness and an edge there before it got corporatized out of it. It became about big distribution. There were still all these really funky, quirky artists that were making careers and had huge followings and interesting careers, and actually interesting things happened. Anything could happen because of the time. Everything was not quite so... coordinated and organized to the extent it is now. So I wanted to make sure everybody goes and sees this film. It has an unusual title, but it is actually a really just fun snapshot of this time and a number of interesting folks, including Leon Russell and a number of other people in the film. But now let's the other part I want to get to, of course, and I jumped over it by going to South by Southwest with the film, was this period of getting the film remastered and distributed. I mean, that's incredible. Just explain that period of time.
Well, it is kind of incredible because everything kind of fit together in a weird way. I had a friend, Anthony Matt, at Prime Focus, and he knew about the film, and he really, in fact, before Les's death, Anthony flew out to have a meeting with Les about remastering his films after his death. And Anthony said that he could do it, and he would do it, and so that's what we did at Prime Focus in New York, and it took a very long time because as I was cleaning up Les's office, I would find more things. And like a shot, like a roll of film.
Oh, really?
That would have a shot on it. And I'm like, what? And then I'd bring it to Prime Focus, and then Anthony would be like, Aaron, I thought we were done. I said, no, look at this. This is a better quality shot, you know, and we could put this in and then scan it. And so we'd get it scanned, and then we'd cut it in. And anyway, it was a lot of versions and a lot of trying to get to the ultimate place in quality to match what Les had, you know. So it was sort of like a bit of a puzzle in a chess game. And then Criterion had put out this box set before Les's death. They had agreed upon the terms for this box set of 14 of Les's films. And then after Les's death, I had found all these images that no one's ever seen that fit with the movies that Criterion was releasing. So I worked with Criterion to try to supply the best imagery for their booklet in the box set. And then once the film was remastered, I thought, you know what? Criterion's already invested so much in the films of Les Blank, including their first release of Burden of Dreams with Werner Herzog to shoe, and then followed by the box set. I just thought, well, this makes a lot of sense to just keep going with Criterion and carry on. And when I submitted the Vimeo link for them to look at, they contacted me the very next day and said, we want to go with this. Yeah.
Makes sense.
So it was all fortuitous and just kind of fit together in that sense. I reached out to some other folks at the same time, but Criterion came back so positive, I said, you know what, I'm going with that.
Yeah, and they contribute to this legacy of the Les Blank that people can really respect and enjoy, right? As far as like finding all of his films, or the majority, maybe. How many films he had? This is about half of them they probably have here, right?
Yeah, I think he has like about 40, and they have now 17.
Okay. How do people see? I guess there's some place now you can go on and rent Criterion titles.
You can do Criterion, you know, with Criterion's website or Hulu. A lot of them are on Hulu channel via Criterion. Mm-hmm. Or you can go to lesblank.com and get DVDs or the box set. And eventually we'll have probably streaming on lesblank.com.
Right, a paywall, as they call it, where people put in their credit card. And
yeah, and you can watch. And then it's just going to get better from here on out. Les had not gone digital very much before his death. That was a hard transition for him, going from film to digital.
Right.
And it's hard for me, too. I've been trained by Les to do film, and I have to let all that go and go digital. And with his business and everything, and remastering and the lasting quality and all that stuff, it's a lot to deal with.
I can imagine. Who knew this was gonna this make? Do you have children?
No. Not yet. Maybe this is my baby right for now.
You need to work on that because it sounds like this might outlast us all.
Yeah.
Last thing, but do you have siblings?
I do. Uh-huh. My brother Beau is actually coming here for the film forum screen.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Okay, for the opening night?
July 1st. At 7:15 is a screening that Leon will be at.
Yes, and Leon is missing today, unfortunately, but he's obviously supporting the film at least to some degree.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He got on board.
Oh, yeah.
Come on. Yeah, we all evolve, right? Yeah. Right, Maureen?
And you know, I think Leon's last album was called Life Journey. Mm-hmm. Life's Journey.
Yeah.
And there may be something to that, you know. Yeah. Life is a journey. And we were talking earlier, Les definitely went through changes. He definitely changed over the course of his life, and Leon probably did too. And we all are.
Well said. Well said. Well, thank you, Harrod, and pleasure to finally meet you.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I'll come back again, I hope.
Thank you.
And Maureen, yeah. And you're busier than ever, Maureen. Is that possible?
Yeah. I guess I am.
The scene on Mouse Music?
There's a few scattered screenings of the St. No Mouse Music coming up in the fall, hopefully in Chicago and finally Seattle and Bisbee, Arizona.
Oh, very nice.
And
using up your points, your flight points and all.
Yeah, gotta get those together. Yeah, and then I finished editing a film called Racing to Zero for other people, Christopher Beaver and Diana Fuller. That's the sort of the ultimate inspiring film about recycling, based on San Francisco's Race to Zero Waste by 2020, Racing to Zero. And then there's a new film by a first-time filmmaker that turned out really great that I edited called A New Color, about this very wonderful 75-year-old African-American artist, teacher, muralist, activist. And that's going to be coming out in the fall. And I'm consultant editing on a film produced by Jed Rife, Mary Rockefeller Morgan, who lives in New York, and about the gene myth, it's called. Unraveling the Gene Myth. Very provocative film.
Sounds like it from the title. Well, thanks again. And you're still in Berkeley, right? Right? The Berkeley area?
Yeah.
Sorry? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again.
Thank you. www.maureengosling.com.
Oh, maureengosling.com. And where's people can find out about screenings and everything on Criterion's page?
Leftblank.com or janusfilms.com. And then look for A Poem as a Naked Person. You get the whole schedule, the press release, downloading pictures, the whole nine yards.
Beautiful. Beautiful film. Yeah. Loved it. Thanks, both of you.
Great.
Very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to the podcast. This has been episode number 302. I'm not going to do a long exit out the door this time. It's going to be very brief. On the next couple of episodes, we have Jeff Lipsky, the filmmaker, who has a new film called Mad Women. Also coming up is filmmaker Sean Baker, who has a new film called Tangerine. Sean's made about four features, and his lead actor in this movie, James Ransone, will be with him. Very excited about that segment. And also coming up shortly is a conversation with the artist and filmmaker Mark LaFia, as well as conversations with Austin-based actors Heather Kafka and Johnny Mars. James Ponsult, the filmmaker behind The Spectacular Now and his new film, The End of the Tour, he's coming on shortly, and much, much more. Thanks for listening. My name is Adam Chartrand. The name of the show is Filmwax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Take care.
You're talking to, a wish that will never come true. You tried to beat gravity.